This interview is being conducted for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Project Number AN08-NJ7. The interview is being conducted by Sarah Corbin, and today I am interviewing John Rowan.
James Rowan Sr. is assisting with the interview.
Here on April 25th, 2012, at 11:30 in the morning, the interview is being conducted in Klawak, Alaska. So, can you start by telling me, John, how long you've lived in Klawak, when your birthday was, and how your family came to be here?
I was born here, born in Ketchikan, but raised here February 11th, 1964. And 40, I lived here basically all my life, except for 4 years where I was in the service. All my family has always been here, as far back as our lineage can go. When the first peoples moved to the Klawak River 10,000 years ago or better, my family line was already there. That came with them. And so we've been here since time immemorial.
Can you tell me about the first people moving to the Klawak River?
From what our elders told me, when the Gunahari and the Tekwedi came from the south, which was around by the Ketchikan area, and they came over the mountains and then settled down here because of the abundance of the sockeye and the herring and wildlife was so great that they could not live here.
And did they live in this area year-round, or was it seasonal?
Far as I know, it was year-round, and there was houses up by the river. That's where the first settlement was up right at the falls. There, and then right across, directly across on the other bank, was more houses.
And how about the area that now encompasses Klawak? When was this settled?
I believe as when the canneries started and the saltery started, because it was such a phenomenal sockeye stream, that probably, and not necessarily down on the front there, more like where the bridge is, and then across on the other side there, across the bay where the canneries were set up, they had seasonal houses there. But for the most part, the true ones came from up in that river.
When the first saltery started here, were people still living up on the river?
Yeah, and not everybody comes from here. You know, they had their own areas that they live in. See, like my our clan house was north of here. You know, where we did have a house on the other side of the river, but for the most part, our territory is north. And same with the rest of them. Our father's people's farther north of here, and they own the islands. And so the clan leader that was there at the time invited all these people to come and live here, and that's when it finally settled. But that was so we could have schools and health and all that business there.
So that was around the time when the canneries were starting. The clan leader living here invited clans from other areas to come in and settle here.
Yeah.
Did people, when they first started to settle from other places, did they stay year-round, or did they just come for part of the year and then go home?
I think they came I'm going to speak to my people. If I get any of this wrong, please forgive me. But I believe most of them, like probably 90% of them, stayed right here. Anymore. Once they came in and it was set up as a permanent town, that they just stayed. Springtime they would go like the hole in the wall for the fishing season there.
Was hole in the wall, a lot of people have talked about going over to hole in the wall. Was that somewhere that anybody could go and get resources, or was that one clan's area?
That was all the clans would go there.
it was open for everyone to go.
All the Hanya Kwan people, that was where they would go.
Were there any stories that you've ever heard about early Spanish or Russian traders getting in this far, or people from this area going out and meeting them and trading?
There was oral histories of boats that had come in, and we have some, you know, there's some stuff in the Spanish chronicles of them coming in, plus our oral histories of talk of them coming in. But not all the way in, you know, it was out in Big Harbor. That's all these people's territory here, this Raven Clan.
Can you tell me about trade during that time?
Well, for me, it'd be speculation, you know. Mm-hmm. But trade is a big thing, you know. We're going to trade for whatever we can get, you know. Iron was probably one of the most sought after articles.
Was there any areas or one area that people would meet at a certain set time
of the year? Mm-hmm. I believe like Fish Egg Island, we call it Shonda and Tlingit, is like when the herring roe would come, they would meet there. You know, and that's, I don't know if it was saying, you know, we're going to have a meeting just like we did here at 11:30, but when the herring came, people came. Mm-hmm. And harvested. It's like the camp at Olinwall when the fish season started. It was the time to make money, and they would meet there. One guy said, okay, we're going to meet here on May 5th. It was just...
So trade would have happened naturally wherever people were putting up food,
yeah.
Processing,
yeah.
And everybody would go to the same places for those activities, and trade would have occurred.
Yeah, well, it's like, let's say, up in Klukwan, they're famous for their hooligan grease. We don't get hooligans and hooligan grease here, so we would trade up that way for that article, and sometimes they would, through oil histories, they would bring it down and trade. That was a major item, was the grease and the hooligans.
What item would people from this area have had to trade that other people would have wanted?
Because it was a chain of trading. We would trade seaweed, sea otter skins, which in turn we would trade to them for the grease. They would in turn take it to the interior, to the Athabascans, to trade for better skins, and you know, mm-hmm. It was a whole network of trading. Mm-hmm. It still goes on today. I traded with a friend of mine for some grease. You know, it took 2 years, but you know, I traded a bunch of seaweed for some grease from Klukwan. You know, and I trade with the people in Wrangell for fresh hooligan and moose meat. You know, we do a lot of trading yet. Mm-hmm. It's one of them things that just never goes away.
Do you remember any of Bayview Boulevard ever being anything but a gravel road?
No, in my time, that's all it was a gravel road. You talk to the older guys, and they remember when it was the boardwalk. And now we got paper. Quite the progression.
Do you remember any boardwalks around town?
No.
Other places?
No. By the time I was born and growing up, they'd already done away with that stuff already.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever go looking around on the beach did you play on the beach and look for things?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
What kind of things would you find?
It's all garbage. Well, basically, that's what it was. You know, back then, you know, everything was just taken down to the beach. It was burned, and tide would come in and flush it out. So whatever was heavy would lay there in the mud. And that, you know, Sandpoint, they had a dock there. There's places there that we would dump stuff, you know.
Off of Zampoing is one place off the dock.
There was a dock there to talk about, and you can see the big, there's a place where they would dump the clamshells. There's a big mound there.
So this water area here was where people would take their trash and let the tide take it out.
When I was a kid, the sewer lines went straight from the toilets right down to the high tide line. Mm-hmm. You know, that was before they put in the sewer system, the really nice one. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any stories about, ever hearing any stories about Zampoing as being a place where folks were cremated?
My aunt used to talk about that. I never heard, you know, anybody else ever talk about it but her. That was Claire Kradovich. And she used to talk about that there used to be a place there. I never heard anybody else, any of my other elders, talk about that. And so I don't know.
Do you remember any of her stories about it? Like, who would have been cremated? Was it anybody, or?
Well, yeah, you know, that was a practice of ours. It's like these poles here, just where all the cremated remains would have gone, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, and I think with the introduction of Christianity, I believe that went away for a large part. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking, you know, late 1800s, things start changing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it might have been going on then. I don't know, you know, because she's the only one that ever talked about that.
So I'm trying to think of if folks moved to this part of Klawock in the late 1800s when the canneries were here. But before that, they were up living up the river.
Yeah.
But they still would have used this area.
Yeah.
And what kind of activities would they be doing?
Fishing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that they would have... Can you remember your Aunt Clara was talking about, do you get the feeling that the cremations were happening before the canneries on this point? Or were they happening
at that time? They would have had to, because we had two right there, two canneries right there. So that would have been right on that area. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the boats coming in, the schooners, like the Spaniards. Mm-hmm. Like mine and his great-grandfather came on a schooner and jumped ship here, and had my grandfather our great grandma up here in the river.
What boat was he on?
I believe Steve called it the Iphigenia. I think. I can't remember, but no.
Where was your great grandfather from?
On the outskirts of Dublin. Steve actually got photos of the family. Our people are buried side by side, mine and his. Yeah, on the outskirts of Dublin.
Hmm. Interesting. When you were a kid, do you remember, apart from people sort of dumping stuff out off the dock and around here, do you remember people doing any other activities along the beach and Baby Boulevard, maybe collecting, chopping firewood, drying fish? What sort of things took place out there?
You're always cutting firewood. They would tow them in, row them in by, row them with the boats. So there's always wood cutting going on, processing fish. Each family, you know, especially from July on, they were working on fish all the time. Not so much as the smokehouses being down there, but farther up, you know.
Did people use any area of the beach, or did they use pretty much stick to the area in front of their house?
Well, you go to where it's easier to pack up to your house. So, you know, right in front of your house, you know. Would be kind of crazy to go and use your neighbor's, which they probably wouldn't say anything when you got your house right there then.
Mm-hmm. And how about place names? Someone had told me that this, at one time, it was called Bayview Island. You ever heard that?
I've heard a couple of the, like Clara, my Aunt Clara. I remember Eleanor Pradovich had said it one time, you know. But I've heard a few of them say it.
And that was called Cloaca Island, I heard.
Yeah.
But now next door is Wadley?
Across the channel? Yeah.
Wadley?
Yeah.
But it used to be, that was Cloaca Island at one point?
No. No, just the one, you know where the dock is?
Oh, yeah.
Right straight across, that's Cloaca Island. That's where a major cannery system was.
Oh, and so Wadley is behind across the channel.
Way
far. Okay. I'm with you. When you were growing up, was it still icing up in the river out here in the bay?
Out in the bay? Oh, yeah.
In the winter?
Yeah. It would last forever, seemed like. And was, I remember one year it was so thick they brought in a Coast Guard icebreaker to break up the ice because that was all we had then, was a plane to deliver the mail and stuff. And they had to break it up in here to get it in, get the planes in.
Because the planes were on floats?
Yeah.
How about, do you remember people's yards getting, having gardens or trees or vegetation, or was it usually sort of disturbed soil? What do you sort of remember around town as a kid?
Oh, there were people who had strawberries, raspberry patches, you know, had flowers, like my dad's aunts had a beautiful garden of lilacs and every kind of bulb flower you'd think of in their yard. So they were, them old people back then were pretty classy. They maintained, they had two-story houses, and they were, you know, these were like fishermen's wives, you know, and they, you know, they were highliners, and so they dressed the part. Always, when I see the old photos, I look at them there, and you know, the road is just a dirt road with full of potholes, and they're dressed to the nines, and they look like they're from the mafia. I mean, fur stoles, the whole bit. Yeah.
What parts of the buildings out on pilings were still here when you were a kid?
Let's see. We had the bowling alley. That was the Woods family owned that. And that was still in operation when I was a kid. And then next to them, coming this way, was Henry Howard's place. He had a workshop that he'd make his oars. His smokehouse, then right around the corner was the outhouse. And then as you went down, and then there was my grandmother's house on the beach. And then you went down, and there was Robert Snook's house. And then you went further down by the dock, there was, we just called him Lonesome, his last name was Jacobs, one of our elder's brothers there. Then there was, the next one was the Widmark house that was on the pilings. And then soon then you get to right on the corner of the Sand Point store, and I remember that. And I didn't remember it when it was open and running, but it was still standing when I was, I remember. And then there was Art Demert's house. And then there was a space there. The Salvation Army had put a trailer there. And then there was Frank Pradovich's house. It was a big two-story place with he ran a store down below it. And then there was a supply building he had stuff in. And then there was a boardwalk out to the old bunkhouse that Bob Pradovich and his family, his sisters and stuff, all nieces resided in there. And you went down, and you would go next to where the old city hall was, and had the fire station. And it went around to the theater, and then the old Nickerson house. And then after that, it kind of runs out. I can't remember after that.
It's exciting. You recognize those places on this 1965 map, maybe?
Let's see.
big house. Okay, there's, I believe that's the bowling alley right here. Because that's the shake mill, and I think that was a cannery. This was already gone by the time. There's Henry Howard's place. Now, this was after 64, because our house is gone, I think.
Because your house got taken away in the
My grandma's
earthquake?
House is down here, and the tidal wave took it. So that might be it there. But I thought it was further down. Robert Snook's, Lonesome's, Widmark's, Sand Point. That must be the old cannery. There's Art Demert's. There's the storage buildings. Frank Pradovich's area here. That's the bunkhouse I was talking about. I don't remember this building. There's the city hall. There's Bob Pradovich's store. There's the theater. And then down here is Nickerson House. And after, and then the old post office was here. But there was a, it was on the dry land. And then after that, none of that. Oh yeah, Willie Skinney's house is right here. He had a little house right here.
Yeah, this is from 1965, so if your grandma's house was taken out in the
tidal
wave. Yeah,
there's the corner then. That's Mrs. Johnson's house. That's Henry Howard's, yeah, okay.
Do you know, can you tell me what Klawak means?
Klawak is actually the name of a Gnachari man that brought his people over this way. It's actually Slawa.
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 Yeah. It's Lawaa. And then as time goes on and English gets involved in it, then it starts changing, which we have now, Klawak. And I don't know the name, what it means, you know. And possibly, like Alicia Roberts, who's a Gnachari Natla, she would probably know. She's the oldest member of their clan.
Any memories for you?
Changed so much from what, you know, even like my dad's age in that group, it's changed. You'd almost see it just being built, the town just being built then. Pretty wild.
Was anybody still building boats when you were growing up?
Yes. David Aniskett Sr. was building boats down here at the cannery and the boat shop.
So he was building boats for the cannery?
In fact, he was working on one for his own.
Oh.
He designed a speedboat. And it was really nice, fast. But he was really good in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know I worked with Steve quite a bit in the early years, and we did documentation of the fish traps up at the estuary, and I can't remember what the ages on some of the trap stakes that go farther back, almost to the wood line. There's a tree line. They were pretty old. Just shows the progression right down to the last one we looked at was they used the salmon seine in the same way you use the lobal, bilobal fish traps. It's just right on up to what we do to this day. And basically, it's all fish, catching them.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
So what you saw in the fish traps is the progression, if I'm getting this right, the progression over time is that...
Just improving.
Improving just it. Improving. Now they're using same nets.
Yeah.
But they're doing the same.
They were using the same pattern as piling up the dirt or the rocks or doing the stake placement. It was just with a same. And this is how Steve got into it. He just wanted to know, wow, when did you guys start doing this here? You know, it was some sort of fisheries. And it just started going back and back and back to where he's out there pulling up stakes and finding out ages. And, you know, so he went backwards and we went forwards.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole coast, that's our whole drive, is the salmon. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole reason. Well, a lot of... Is that off?
Or,
go ahead.
Okay.
Because it's published material, and I've read it too, and I've heard it. As they believe that those Russians that had went for water and never returned came. Eventually, their bloodline came to Kluwak, or they came to Kluwak. And the most prominent, you know, like the Pradovich, and so, you know, they think that's, you know, Bob Pradovich and all, and the Roberts, and that, where that came, where that may have, maybe, that's the speculation.
You know, do you remember the beads being used on clothing or in decoration or that sort of thing? Do you remember people using those beads?
The blue Russian ones that they highly prize. When I was a kid, I'd never seen them being used for anything. Not to say that they weren't, but I never seen them. Or the white heart red ones. But as a kid, we used to find them, and one old lady would buy them for pennies from us. But the seed beads, our grandma was a beader, and so there were a lot of them that did that.
But I can't think of any thing that I've seen that is beadwork with those blue beads on.
No.
That has been made or attributed to Tlingit.
Even when you look back in the oldest photos, you don't see that. You don't see them. Mm-hmm. I don't see them. And I'm a carver, so I look at detail. Mm-hmm. Everything in detail. I look at this littlest speck to see something that we may have missed, you know.
Actually, I take that back. I do remember seeing, do you know that book, Crossroads?
But, you know, one thing that's interesting is, though, that doesn't come from the Tlingit culture. That's from the Koniaks and the Aleuts in that area there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, that's not on a Tlingit hat, though.
So the...
Or a Chugach, or, you know, that bunch in that area there. Yeah.
Because they also did, like, the spruce root hats.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And wooden ones with them in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we've got beads just like that. You know, the ones that the Aleuts have on their hunting hats.
Mm-hmm.
I found some of myself just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somebody called them Chinese beads. They look like little lemons, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, so it's interesting that it, what, you know, I haven't seen anything yet that, and not to say that it wasn't, but I haven't seen anything yet that where we wore it as dress or decoration.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go farther north, then you start seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, if you're thinking that this is a trade item, what are people doing with them?
It. Yeah.
Why would they why would they say, yeah, I'll take 10 beads instead of saying I'll take that copper kettle or what have you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, especially if you're not seeing it in being turned into anything else.
Yeah, they would have traded more for the small seed beads for the beading that they were doing.
Mm-hmm. So then, you know, as a possibility, where they're, say, during the Russian fur trading era, you know, were they sending some of the Aleut hunters, you know, are there stories of those guys coming down here and looking for sea otter?
One time.
Can you tell me about that story?
They came on a Russian fur boat into Big Harbor, set up camp, and before morning, they all but wiped them out and sent them packing.
The
Russians and the Aleuts.
The Tlingit wiped them out and sent them back.
Hmm. Yeah. They never set up a post on here.
Mm-hmm.
But they did do the trading, though,
because
mm-hmm. they would come by, but they wouldn't let them set up a post.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Phenomenal beater, and I practically lived with her when I was little, and she never made one mention of them ever.
Of the blue trade beads?
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting. The one lady that would buy them from us was Bob Pradovich's daughter. I believe it's her daughter or cousin. One of them lived out in the bunkhouse there. She would buy them from us for, you know, a few pennies. But back then, a few pennies was worth something.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Back when penny candies were penny candies.
Yeah. Shoot, if you made 50 cents, you got to go to the movie.